It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the program, we'll talk to a guest who says the children's movies of today are taking their message of self-esteem to the extreme, and it's time for a reality check.
First off, it is back to school season, and for many school districts in Wisconsin, today is the first day of classes. For some students, that's a cause for celebration, but for others, well, there might be some kicking and screaming on the way out the door. And that got us thinking today about how we felt when we went back to school. Those are powerful first memories.
Yeah, I remember not minding so much going back to school. I missed the summer, though. Knowing that all that time was gone. That I'd frittered away, probably. Anyhow, for today's nostalgia segment, we want to hear from you. Looking back, how did you feel about going back to school? Do you have any favorite back-to-school memories? Or maybe you're a parent who sent your kid off to school today for the first time or last week. What emotions are you feeling today, and how'd they do with it? You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And here to kick things off with us is our producer, Galen Druk. And hey, Galen, welcome. Thanks for being on this side of the glass today.
Thank you for inviting me over.
Your memories kind of got us going. And again, we hope that people will join us at 1-800-642-1234. Now, your memories, to understate it, were not the happiest of back-to-school memories, right?
No, yeah. For a long time, I don't know. I'll probably make myself sound like a big wimp, but between, I would say, the age of kindergarten and fourth grade, I cried every first day of school. And it wasn't just like I woke up in the morning and sort of getting ready. I was, you know, crying. Like, I don't really want to go to school. I would keep it together. I would, you know, get on the bus, get to school, make it into my, you know, classroom, and then just start sobbing. And of course, you know, most kids don't do that. Like, most kids are way more, you know, excited or, like, you know, happy to see their friends again, or at least, like, nervous. But I would just maybe sometimes for, like, an hour or whatever, you know, just, like, sit there and cry. And so that was not a great way to start off the first day of school.
And I would like to reassure anyone listening that you, Galen, turned out relatively normal.
Yeah, actually, okay, so it all ended once I got into fifth grade, which is, you know, it's kind of weird because I moved schools when I entered fifth grade. We moved and I went to, you know, it was all the kids were going to a new school at that point. That was the start of middle school. And it was, you know, a completely new town. I didn't know anybody. And I think I was finally just thought to myself, if I'm going to make any friends here, I have to keep it together. Like, I have to just try to, you know, make it through the first day of school without, you know, being a crying mess.
Well, now, how about you? We'd envisioned this as a call-in segment. Do you have favorite cherished memories or sad memories or a funny story about a first day back at school or a story about your own kid headed back to school today or last week if you started earlier? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email, talk@WPR.org. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, I am going to say this is not how I personally feel, but I have spoken with a lot of parents who say that they are so relieved when school starts, that finally things are back in a routine, they have a little bit of breathing space, and the kids are off gainfully employed at school. I don't necessarily feel that way, but it is something that some parents experience. You know, it's bittersweet for a parent. Rob and I, you know, we know how that feels.
It's bittersweet for the kids, too, right?
Maybe it's just bitter.
Yeah, well,
it can be sweet, too.
Well, definitely, as a parent, I don't remember crying on my own first days of school,
right.
But yes, after putting the kids on the bus or whatever, and I'm thinking back to kindergarten, first grade here, we're pretty much over it. Today, we did first day of school, and it was pretty routine.
And actually, did you cry today, Rob?
Today, no. No. But back in the day,
yeah.
yes, I got a bit teary, definitely.
Yeah, you're an easy crier, but yeah. Still, it's an emotional moment.
It's true.
Well, I think the overwhelming, sort of once I got over crying, the overwhelming feeling of going back to school was kind of the feeling of starting anything that you know you're going to be doing for a while, you know, a new job, moving to a new house, whatever it may be. You wake up in the morning, you know, assuming you slept the night before, which I definitely didn't always, you know, sleep well the night before the start of school. And you think to yourself, oh my God, like, I have to do this so many more times before whatever this phase in my life is over. And
right.
Just that, like, daunting feeling of, like, oh, this yeah. is just number one.
And my son's to the age where he can conceptualize how many more times he's going to be doing this. And he asked me about it, and I didn't know how to tell him that this would pretty much go on, hopefully, all the way through college.
Yeah, until he was 22.
Right. So I try to kind of sugarcoat that. And hopefully, I've heard he had a great third grade first day today. So I don't hear great. About any tears like yours, Galen. But that's okay, too. Look, it all turned out okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's. We've got some callers now. We'll go to Joanne in Madison. Joanne, hi there. You're on the air.
Hi. September 3rd is my birthday. And so
happy birthday.
When I was a kid, thank you. And when I was a kid, I was always torn. You know, I wanted my birthday to come, but I didn't want to have to go to school. And but when I was in grade school, I went to a Catholic grade school. And back then, it was we had the nuns with the habits and all that stuff. And it was traumatizing. I was scared to death. And I would cry.
Oh.
I would walk to school, and I would cry.
Well, you made it through.
Yeah,
I did. I did. And I am perfectly, you know, happy where I am. And, you know, I'm glad I went, you know, not that I'm glad that I was traumatized, but, you know, it's just all part of who I am now. So it worked out good.
Great. Well, thank you for sharing your story, Joanne. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, thanks to Joanne for that. And someone who's similar to you there, Galen. But apparently this is something that people can work with and move through. And Galen, thank you so much for stopping by and kicking us off on our school memories today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me over.
All right. Let's go back to the phone zone. We have Chet on the line from Randolph. Hi, Chet.
Hi.
Hi. What's your school memory?
Well, that was many years ago when I was living in Randolph. That was kindergarten, my first day of kindergarten. And my mother took me, and all I did was cry until first of all, I cried because I didn't have any crayons. And then Foley Horkheimer let me use his crayons. And Foley and I became good friends through kindergarten, first, second, and third grade, and then I moved back to our farm. And then I discovered many years later, many, many years later, that Foley Horkheimer was the stargazer on TV. And I don't remember if it was public television or what, but he was called Stargazer. But he was my friend in Randolph, Wisconsin. And that was, I'm 75, so that was probably about 70 years ago.
Wow. Well, all thanks to those shared crayons.
Yeah, you bet. Well, I know. That made it for me.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Chet, for sharing your story. Appreciate it.
Right. Yep. Bye.
And let's move next to Wendy. Wendy joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Wendy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, what's your memory?
Now I'm a grandmother, but when my kids were little and the first day of school and that big yellow bus would come and eat them up, and it made me so sad. And my neighbor felt the same way, and as soon as the bus had come past and picked them all up, she would call, and we'd commiserate about how sad it was that they had to go to school. And they didn't mind at all.
Well, and the good news was the bus came back later and spat them back out to you, right?
Yes. which was wonderful. But so now that my grandchildren are off to school and kind of feeling the same nostalgia.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you so much, Wendy. Yeah, I can relate to that as well, that feeling of watching your little one's face in the window going farther and farther away. There's something about that school bus. I think that makes it a little more, at least for me, poignant than dropping them off at the door. The school bus kind of does it.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for your calls. You can keep sharing at the Central Time Facebook page your back-to-school memories, whether from 70 years ago in a box of crayons or this morning at the bus stop.
And we can go next to Nick in Greenfield. Nick, are you with us? Oh, I'm sorry, Nick. We don't have you there.
Okay. Well, coming up next, our next guest says the children's movies of today are reinforcing the cult of self-esteem, and it's time to re-examine a classic movie from 1969 for a reality check.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. Well, according to our next guest, no genre in recent years has been more predictable than the children's movie, and their messages of encouragement and self-esteem are being taken to an extreme.
He says it's time to re-examine a classic kids movie from 1969 for a reality check. Let's take a listen.
It's my turn next. Here's my first word of the spelling bee. Failure? Yes, ma'am. That's an easy one.
Boy, that's one word he should know well.
Failure. F-A-I-L-U-R-E. Failure.
That's a clip from A Boy Named Charlie Brown, the movie our next guest thinks Hollywood can learn a thing or two from.
We're joined now by Luke Eplin. He's a freelance journalist, and his new piece in The Atlantic is called You Can Do Anything. Must Every Kids Movie Reinforce the Cult of Self-Esteem? And we've got a link to it on the Central Time Facebook page. Luke, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Can you talk about the crop of kids' movies that were released this summer and how it got you thinking about the basis for this article?
Well, I actually started in reverse. I saw A Boy Named Charlie Brown on the recommendation of a friend in February, and I was rather shocked by it. I think that it's a movie that that goes against a lot of conventions. Charlie Brown is a failure at the beginning of the movie. He suffers through sort of humiliation, failures, all the whole thing. And at the end of the movie, he ends up qualifying for this major spelling bee and ends up kind of failing in a tremendously embarrassing fashion at it. And it really shocked me to have a children's movie operate like this. And so I decided that I was going to take a look at some of the more recent children's films that were released and see how it compares to this movie.
Well, let's give a listen to one of those movies. This is one out this summer called Planes.
I've flown thousands of miles, and I've never been anywhere. Not like you. You were built to fight, and look what you did. You're a hero. I'm just trying to prove that maybe, just maybe, I can do more than what I was built for.
So that's a crop duster, I believe, who wants to be a racing plane. And if he believes he can do it, he can. You talk a lot about the magic feather syndrome in the movies you're looking at. What is that?
Yeah, that's the magic feather syndrome is a phrase that I've coined for this this piece. And generally, what it means is that these movies are revolving around these sort of anthropomorphized figures who have to overcome the restrictions of their societies or even their species to realize these sort of impossible dreams. They have a sort of liability in the case of Planes, as you mentioned. The titular character is a crop duster, and he wants to be a world-class racer. So crop dusters generally aren't known for being very good racers. But it actually turns out to be kind of a strength for him. He's able to do things other planes aren't able to do. But first, he has to sort of relinquish the clutch of the magic feather and sort of believe in himself and realize that he's had it in him all along to accomplish his dreams.
But it's not just this one movie. I mean, you cite a whole mess of children's movies who have this same theme of believing in yourself, overcoming the odds, and you say not working very hard for it. You mentioned Wreck-It Ralph. There's Turbo, a snail who gets to drink some magic juice and suddenly he's very fast.
Right.
And the list just keeps going on. And it's funny because I didn't really realize what a sort of phenomenon this was until I read the list of all these kids' movies. What are some of the other ones?
Well, yeah, I mentioned a few in my piece. Turbo and Planes were the ones that I really examined. And I thought that they were interesting because they basically have similar plots. The characters have similar motivations. And they were released by separate studios within a month of each other. And so it does seem like they are a sort of default template for what I think is the most common animation plot now. I mentioned in my piece Ratatouille, where you have a sewer-dwelling rat who dreams of becoming this sort of world-class French chef. Kung Fu Panda, where you have a fat panda who's going to become a kung fu master. Wreck-It Ralph, a video game villain who wants to be a hero, and it sort of goes on and on. I should mention, though, that I think that these movies exist on a sort of spectrum where they're not all sort of reinforcing what I'm calling the cult of self-esteem. I think that certain movies like Turbo and Planes are very very sort of out there in terms of having these characters dream impossible dreams and then by the end of the movie sort of make it. There are movies that sort of have these conventions that are still quite good. I think Ratatouille is a fantastic movie, but it does sort of adhere to that template still.
But you can't have a movie about a sewer rat who loves to cook and learns at the end of the day that rats can't cook. They can't be chefs. I mean, that's not a movie, is it? So what should the lesson be?
Well, no, it's not a movie to have that. And I'm not saying that these movies shouldn't be hopeful or inspirational or anything like that. And actually, I think Ratatouille is a really fine movie. It's very well executed. I think some of the problems that I have with these movies are that they have these characters doing sort of impossible or sort of things that you wouldn't expect, like a crop duster or a snail, to do. And it's fun to take that journey along with them. But at the end of the day, if you're going to have them compete in Turbo's case, the Indianapolis 500, where a snail competes against these race car drivers, or in Plains' case, where you have a crop duster in the world's foremost racing event, you take these characters from zero to the top of the world in basically one step. And so you're not showing that there's any sort of sacrifice or there's any sort of struggle that it would take to get to the top of this ladder. It's basically you go from the bottom rung all the way to the top in one step. And I think that there's something problematic about that message.
Well, maybe we skip some steps there, but it isn't a positive message. Don't accept limitations. You can go out and do anything you want. Don't let tall odds stand in your way. Is that wrong?
No, I don't think necessarily it is wrong, and I think that you're right that there is a very positive message to be had in there about making sure that kids don't have avenues closed off to them whenever they're thinking about these movies or themselves or what they're learning from these movies. But I do think that there are some ways of presenting it that are perhaps better than others. Like, I don't necessarily think that it's a negative thing to portray failure in these sorts of movies. I think that the very fact that in Planes, for example, this crop duster even qualifies for this amazing race, considering he's never entered a race in his life, is a victory enough, and I don't necessarily think that he would need to win this race to prove anything to himself. And I think that, in fact, it might have a better lesson for him and perhaps for the audience, for him to lose to a decorated, respected opponent and sort of learn from that.
So, Luke, American parents have been criticized for being overly praising of their kids, lavishing it on too much, and teaching them that they're special, even though they haven't done anything to earn the word special. And, you know, you look at the millennial generation, and people talk about how the millennials think they're entitled to things without having worked for them. Do you think what you're seeing in children's films is symptomatic of where we are as a society right now?
I think that one could draw that conclusion, certainly. As I mentioned, the fact that these two films, Turbo and Planes, came out within a month of each other and by separate studios, and they basically have the same paint-by-numbers plot, indicates that this has become a sort of default template for the animation industry to fall back on. And I think you have to ask yourself, where does that come from, and how did that become the default? And I think that the fact that, yeah, you do have this society in which we do like to teach children that they are special and that they should pursue their dreams at all costs is reflected in these movies. I think it is, you know, you can get into a cliche about these generations having everybody gets a trophy sorts of thing. I don't know. I don't use that language in my piece, but I do think that these movies are reflecting something in the culture.
We're talking with Luke Eplin, a freelance journalist who wrote about the cult of self-esteem in kids' movies. New ones, the ones out this summer, like Planes and Turbo, other ones as well. And we want to know what you think. Are kids' movies today taking their message of self-esteem too far? Are we as a society going too far to promote self-esteem for kids? Would you like these films to reintroduce ideas of failure, humility, and what to do when you get beat down, like Charlie Brown? And we're going to talk about that coming up after the break. Here's how you can join us. Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get to your calls and more on this topic coming up after the news.
You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our discussion with Luke Epstein and Eplin, and we'll take your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And we want to know, are the kids' movies today taking their message of self-esteem too far? And would you like to see these films learn a thing or two from Charlie Brown?
We'll get to your calls in just a few moments. Luke, before we do that, though, we're hearing the Charlie Brown, the Peanuts theme song there. We were talking actually during the news. Some of those Peanuts movies and TV specials and the comic strip itself, for that matter, it was pretty harsh and sad. I mean, are today's kids ready for a litany of failure?
Well, I agree with you. I think that the Peanuts specials and the comic strip are exceptional in a way, because Charlie Brown is a character who his defining characteristic is the fact that he fails. And so we are expected to see him fail, and because of that, it's not as shocking whenever it happens, because that's just in keeping with his personality and in keeping with the way that the strip and the specials move. So if you transfer that onto, say, a Disney movie where you have a character that just constantly fails and the end of the movie ends in sort of disappointment, I think it would be quite shocking and probably not a very good movie.
Well, but if there's a lesson there, if it's how you cope with failure in a noble way. I mean, isn't there like some kind of midpoint they could be working toward?
Absolutely. In fact, I think that Charlie Brown is, despite the fact that Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts, set him up for failure quite a lot, I think that there is kind of a virtue in this character. He's the pitcher of his baseball team who gets defeated every game in really embarrassing fashion. Yet the virtue of Charlie Brown is that he keeps coming back again and again and again. He perseveres. He doesn't necessarily wallow so much in self-pity as that he tries and tries again. And A Boy Named Charlie Brown is about him failing repeatedly until the very end, whenever he loses the spelling bee, he's in bed and he says that, "I'm just never going to try anything again." And rather than Linus telling him, like, "Oh, don't worry, you're going to find your thing, Charlie Brown," Linus just says, "Well, you know what, Charlie Brown, the world goes on regardless." And so it is this sort of this message that you have to carry on. I just want to add that I think this is at the other end of the extreme from Planes and Turbo. You have Planes and Turbo on one end and Charlie Brown on the other, and there's a vast middle ground that I would like to see a little bit to have explored more. I think that the movies have gone too far towards the one end of Planes and Turbo, and they should be brought a little bit back more towards the end of Charlie Brown.
All right, let's get our callers in on this. We've got John Paul joining us from Janesville. Hi there.
Hi there. I recently watched Wreck-It Ralph with my 5-year-old son and my wife, and I'm a huge fan of it. I'm a fan of video games in general. But I also feel that it really represents good middle of the spectrum, in my opinion, because it truly shows a character obviously a villain that is pretty much despised. And he actually is given his medal. He's given that trophy that we keep talking about and keep hearing in the news about. and ends up losing it because he didn't, I felt, because the character didn't earn it. And I felt that was a great message for kids, that you really have to sacrifice, which he did. He sacrificed his friends, his family, his video game family, and everyone around him was just given everything because that's what their role was. And I thought that was a nice way of changing the script a little bit. And I think you touched right on it with Charlie Brown, how it's a message of hope, where you keep trying to kick the football, even though you know Lucy's probably going to take it away.
All right. Well, thank you so much, John Paul. What do you think about Wreck-It Ralph?
Well, those are very good points that he makes. And one of the criticisms of my piece that I'll wholly admit up to is that it is a little bit black and white in the way that it's presented, because I'm using these extremes with Planes, Turbo, and A Boy Named Charlie Brown. And there is a middle ground in which a lot of these movies operate. And I think Monsters University and Wreck-It Ralph, while they basically take the sort of bare-bones structure from a Magic Feather Syndrome thing, where one character wants to do something that you wouldn't expect of this character, they manage to subvert that genre a lot and bring in these lessons, like this caller very rightly said. And so I don't necessarily disagree with that so much.
Thanks a lot for the call, John Paul. We'll go now to Polly in Wauwatosa. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, thanks. Interesting program, and it's always great to be able to have NPR to expand our minds. I was interested in your comments from the perspective of being a parent and a grandparent. And I guess the comment that most triggered my thoughts was your comment about things did not happen in single stages. And I couldn't agree more as an adult. But as I look at children and the purpose of books and stories and movies in the lives of children, I think that they need to be developed and managed or matched to a child's cognitive level. So we have children who are in very, very different places in what they can think and feel as they grow, and that different kinds of stories need to be for different kinds of children, and they need to be age and developmentally appropriate for someone and not necessarily for everyone. And I guess as a parent, I was often concerned about some of the violence that existed and some of the Snow White kind of stories, and what was that doing with children? And was very happy to run across the work of Bruno Bettelheim, a psychiatrist who talked about how children have these concerns and fears that are very, very different than adults, and that all of these stories that children became attached to were actually helping them work through some of their biggest fantasies.
Gotcha. We don't have too much time left, Polly. Interesting point. Thoughts on any of what she had to say, Luke?
Yeah, that's a really good point I think she's making about the cognitive level of children and the way that you have to sort of pitch these movies to them, and how adults have to always keep that into account. That said, I don't know if they necessarily have to sort of center around these sort of impossible dream scenarios where a character is shown achieving these amazing goals without having any sort of experience, sacrifice, or necessarily struggle through them. I think that they could be a little bit more, inject a little more humility and modesty into these sorts of things. But a point well taken.
So, Luke, there's been a lot of research lately that kids who are told, you know, you're great at this, congratulations, you're special, they actually have lower self-esteem and they don't try as much. You know, you mentioned Charlie Brown kept kicking that football. If you had a message, you know, to give the producers of these films, what would you tell them to start writing about?
Oh, boy, that's a big question. Call on your first point. I think that if you are expected to succeed, or at least to gain sort of encouragement whenever you do experience a sort of failure, your instinct might be to just stop doing that, or to not try it again in the way that Charlie Brown is doing. And so And so, yeah, I think it can be perhaps detrimental to always have this sort of success being shown. But yeah, I guess my message would just be to look more towards the Charlie Brown model and inject more sorts of things about failure and disappointment into these films without making them depressing like Charlie Brown. Of course. I still want them to be hopeful.
You know, my kid loves Charlie Brown, even though he is
really
depressing. So there's something there, I think. I think you might be onto something. Kids today still love Charlie Brown.
Well, some people have told me that kids don't necessarily identify with him now because he is someone who doesn't win and in fact is never really encouraged. He's kind of bullied almost. And so I heard that kids identify with Snoopy more than Charlie Brown now.
And he doesn't have the best hair either, but there is still something there.
No, that's poor guy.
All right. Well, Luke, thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you.
Luke Eplin is a freelance journalist, and his piece, You Can Do Anything, Must Every Kids Movie Reinforce the Cult of Self-Esteem, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll look at how Congress is going to handle the issue of military intervention in Syria. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last Saturday, President Obama announced that he'll take his resolution for military intervention in Syria to Congress.
Congress is still on recess until next Monday, but speculation and political maneuvering has already begun.
And after speaking with the president this morning, the top two Republicans in the House, Speaker John Boehner and Majority Leader Eric Cantor, have come out in support of the resolution on Syria.
And here with us to discuss the dynamics in Congress is Paul Singer, Congress and Politics Editor at USA Today. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Sure. My pleasure, Veronica. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Well, let's start with President Obama. Why do you think he decided to take his resolution to Congress? It looked as little as a week ago as though that might not be the case.
Yeah. As of Friday, we were planning to not have to worry about Congress for a couple of weeks. And then suddenly, as of Saturday morning, this was a Congress story. It's hard to say why exactly. I honestly believe the president thought he needed to have some support, and some support of the American people, some support of the Congress, perhaps some support of the international community. You know, he had just seen a defeat of a measure like this in the British Parliament, and I get the impression that he didn't want to be seen as going alone, particularly with public opinion polls at the time being pretty strongly against. So it might just be that he honestly wants Congress to be standing with him when he pursues this attack.
It does raise the question why he would expose himself to the possibility of the same kind of failure that we saw in Britain. He is a second-term president. He doesn't necessarily need to do this as it stands now. Why do you think, you know, he made that choice to take on a battle that it's possible that he could lose?
Well, and it's very clear that most of his advisors were telling him not to. They were telling him he didn't have to, that he could lose, and that the cost of losing would be devastating to his presidency. Again, what we have heard and what we have reported is that the president basically on Friday afternoon walked around the building a couple of times with one of his aides, came back in and told everybody else, you know what, I'm going to go run this through Congress. It's, I think, a very risky maneuver. However, if he does win approval from Congress, he has a much stronger hand going forward.
So I don't know if the phrase arm twisting is apropos here or not, because evidently you're really not supposed to twist arms on matters of conscience like this is.
Nonsense.
But what is he doing behind the scenes to make sure this vote swings his way?
He has been having one-on-one conferences where necessary with top leaders in Congress. He has been having, the White House has been briefing basically everybody in Congress. They have been sending out his top team in force to tell every member of Congress, one, we are very, very, very serious about this intelligence. We are certain that Bashar Assad used chemical weapons against his own people. Two, this is a horrible thing, and America has to do something about it. And three, if America doesn't do something about it, we're going to empower our enemies, basically. Their argument is that doing nothing makes it look like there are no consequences for this kind of activity and makes the country look weak. Now, I suspect they are also saying, and by the way, since the president has already said he wants to do something, if Congress says no, it will make the president look essentially useless. I mean, he will be powerless. And so I suspect they're saying you have to save us from what would be international humiliation.
Well, I suppose the president could look useless, but is it possible also that the United States could look useless, lacking in military resolve when it comes to questions like this, and that if you're watching from abroad, you could say, well, maybe we can cross the red line.
Yeah, that's very much what their argument is. Now, I will tell you that has not been a non-controversial stance. There are people who are saying, oh, look, the only reason we're in this box is because the president drew a red line he didn't need to draw, and then was stuck with it, and then the rest of the American people are stuck with it. There's also the argument that we're in this box because, and this is something that Senator McCain and Lindsey Graham said yesterday, which was very interesting, that they said they're beginning to come around to supporting the president's call for military action. But their argument was, this is a terrible way to manage the situation, and the reason we're here is because we haven't been active. We weren't active 2 years ago, basically. They say the Obama administration has been neglectful of the Syrian situation, and if they hadn't been neglectful during this period of time, we'd be in a much better position now.
It looks as though Senator McCain and Lindsey Graham are now moving their support to President Obama on this. What has he said to convince them?
Well, yesterday what he said to convince them was, their point was they don't think we should just take a random strike in retaliation for this chemical weapons attack and then walk away. That we can't just have a one-off military strategy. They want some sort of coherent strategy to really, as they said, degrade the abilities and the capabilities of the Assad regime and improve the capabilities of the Syrian Free Army, Free Syrian Army, which is the opposition group that we like. And they came out of the White House yesterday saying that they heard that from the president. A strategy is emerging, as they said, that is more comprehensive and more long-term and more than just, you know, fling a couple cruise missiles and go home. So that was what, and they're still saying they are not a yes vote yet, but they were very much more supportive as of yesterday afternoon than they had been 2 days earlier.
Who do you see as being most likely to oppose President Obama as he tries to go forward and get support for this?
Well, Rand Paul. There's actually a kind of an intellectual framework within the Republican Party that is very non-interventionist. And Rand Paul is kind of the poster child of that movement. There are also in the House, there are probably 30 or 40 Republicans who are very opposed to U.S. intervention overseas for philosophical reasons. They don't think it's worth spending the money. They don't think it gets us anywhere internationally. They believe that in cases like this, you're contributing to essentially a quagmire. We don't have any real clear goals. We don't have any real useful strategies. It's not clear what we're going to get into. We certainly don't want boots on the ground in Syria. There is a group of not an insignificant group of members of Congress and I think the American public as well that is just really leery of getting involved in some kind of another Iraqi mess, basically.
And it sounds like there are those who say if we back President Obama on this, we also want some assurance that military funding is going to be restored.
Right. This guy out of Dayton, I think his name is Turner, Congressman Turner, who has said basically that there's a great concern that the military has been very weakened by a decade of war, the sequester cuts, that is the across-the-board budget cuts the government absorbed this year have hurt the Pentagon budget. And they just are concerned about adding another expensive conflict into a budget cycle where the Pentagon is already struggling. I should also mention that there's also a bunch of liberals in the House who are concerned that they don't want to go to war either. That's being led by a couple of guys. One of them, Alan Grayson, is a Democrat from Florida, who's actually started a campaign on the Internet to get people to sign a petition to stop the war. So it's not just Republicans who are opposed to this. There will be some Democrats opposed as well.
If Obama does get some key figures on board, Senator McCain, mm-hmm. Lindsey Graham, maybe Speaker Boehner as well, does that mean he still needs to worry about Republicans breaking rank, or do you think that he's going to have smooth sailing at that point?
In the Senate, I don't think he has to be as concerned. In the Senate, it looks like they will have enough support in the Senate to pass this thing. The House is a more interesting deal. This is, again, one of the situations where the Democrats are in the minority in the House of Representatives, but they're probably going to provide the majority of the votes in favor of a bill like this. So I think the concern for the White House is going to be, you know, making sure, first of all, the Republican leadership in the House is on board, which they seem to be at the moment, and then making sure that the Democrats can keep as many as possible of their party in line. And even on that front, I will say today has been a better day for Obama. We've seen a couple of statements from liberals who might otherwise be anti-war saying that they're leaning towards it now. And I think that would give the White House a little more comfort.
What role does Nancy Pelosi have in all of this?
Well, Nancy Pelosi is the leader of Democrats, and she's in charge of counting. again, they will tell you that these are votes of conscience and we don't push people on them, but that's not really true. And in fact, today, Nancy Pelosi sent out a letter to all of her colleagues in the Democratic Party saying, I think this is an important vote, and here's the reasons why. So, you know, they are in position to twist some arms, to make the case. I mean, in part, they might also be saying, this is a Democratic president, guys, and we can't have him embarrassed. But I think they're also making the case that, again, this is a horrific attack by a bad guy. We can't just turn our backs and do nothing.
So already a fair amount of time has passed since this red line was crossed, since we thought we had evidence of chemical weapons being used. And then you've got President Obama now turning to Congress, and in essence, you know, Congress, you know, via the American people to get support for this. How big a deal or how damaging will it be for the country if this turns into a big battle? We've had a lot of partisan politics lately. What will it be like then?
Well, I don't know. It's going to take another week at a minimum. Congress, you know, they're having a hearing in the Senate today, but Congress doesn't actually come back officially into session until Monday. And then they got a bunch of stuff they got to do before they can vote on this. It's going to be 2 weeks. Before they can actually vote on this thing, or you know, close to 2 weeks. So if it gets longer than that and there turns into a big bloodbath on the floor of the House, that will be excellent for us in the news business. I can't say much about what it means for the country. It's not my problem. But I don't think that's going to happen. I suspect this will be over at the end of the following week, and then we can get back to the fighting over the other stuff like the budget and the immigration, things that we're more entertained by.
Well, we're talking right now with Paul Singer, Congress and Politics Editor at USA Today, and we want to know what you think about this. What do you think about President Obama taking the case to Congress and getting permission before he moves forward? Is this how you want to see it happening, and what do you hope will come out of it? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.